All right, hello, and welcome to the first week of section for Computer Science E52. If you're tuning in online and you're looking for the section for Computer Science 50, you've come to the right place. The course is different in name only. So today we're going to be talking about SSHing, what exactly that means, how to SSH to get to connect to a remote server, the Unix command line, the Nano text editor, and also a little bit dabbling with the C language so that we can essentially get you prepared to move forward and work on the first problem set, which is out this week. All right, so first we're going to talk about SSH and what exactly that is. So SSH stands for Secure Shell. And if you're not familiar with what the concept of a shell is essentially akin to a terminal. So if you've ever opened up like in Linux or Mac OS or perhaps even Windows at a DOS prompt, some terminal with like a blinking cursor that allows you to type in commands rather than click and drag files around, that would be akin to what we refer to in Linux as the shell. So a secure shell allows you to connect over the internet to a different computer and using your own keyboard and monitor, essentially manipulate the files and programs which are present on that computer on another server from the comfort of your own home using your own local machine. So essentially, I can use this laptop, connect over the internet to the CS50 cloud, this cluster of computers which you use for the course, and interact with that from wherever I might go thanks to the power of the internet. So if you have trouble visualizing that, we'll just take a look at the diagram, which should make it a little more explicit. So we start out with this nice beige box here, which should be very familiar to everyone, a desktop PC. And then we have you, some user, who's sitting at the keyboard, connecting the machine, also with some monitor, which doesn't have anything interesting on it just yet. All you can access is what you find on your computer. So fortunately for you, this computer is also connected to the internet. And connected to the internet as well is this cluster of servers, which is representing the CS50 cloud. This is where everything that you're going to be working on during the course of the semester is going to be stored, on this network of computers on the internet, which you can access from anywhere. So we assume that you have some SSH client that you can use to connect over the internet to these servers. So you, sitting over here at home on your keyboard, type in some commands. All right. And these commands are sent through the internet to this cluster of servers, which sends back a response. And then, voila, you are logged into the CS50 cloud, and you're able to interact with that machine as if you were sitting at it yourself. So how exactly do you do this on your machine? If you happen to be using a Windows box, you should download the program that I would recommend and the course also recommends. It's called PuTTY. It's very simple. You can just Google PuTTY, go to the first result, and download the executable file. You don't even have to install it. It's that simple. You download the executable. You run that. It opens up a window that looks very much like this. You'll see here we have this option for this field, which says host name or IP address. This is where you will type cloud.cs50.net, or if you want to save yourself the trouble of typing in your username after the window opens, you can expedite this by typing whatever your username is at cloud.cs50.net. Sort of looks like an email address. And you'll notice above it looks sort of like a web address as well, but it's distinct from that. If I tried to open cloud.cs50.net in a web browser, which perhaps if you were just skimming the beginning of the problems that you did try, you would find that it does not work since this is a server which we're able to access through SSH rather than through an HTTP connection through a web browser. So that is distinct. If you're on Mac OS, there's a program built right into Mac OS, which you can use called the Terminal. If you're not familiar with using it previously, you can use, I think it's called Spotlight, to search for the program found somewhere on the machine. Just type in Terminal. It should come up relatively easily. Open that up. It'll give you a familiar command line interface. Type in SSH, then a space, then cloud.cs50.net to tell the machine to establish an SSH connection to that server. Or, once again, you can type your username at cloud.cs50.net to let it know who you are before you actually log in. And if you happen to be using Ubuntu Linux or some other variant of Linux, it's essentially the same steps. So you should be all set there. All right. So before we continue talking about conditions and other aspects of the C programming language, let's take a step back and actually use PuTTY to connect to the server and take a look at the environment we're going to be working in this semester. So I opened up this window. Since I entered Chartier at cloud.cs50.net, Chartier being my username on the cloud, I'll see here I'm being prompted for a password. So I just type that in. Notice that no characters are appearing on the screen. My password is secret, so the terminal will not display it, but it is accepting all those characters as I type them. Then I hit enter, and here I am on the CS50 cloud. So now what do? If I have not used Unix before, I might be really confused and kind of just like rendered unawares at this point. So we're going to have to go over a couple of commands which you can use in the terminal. So as an analogy, suppose you're working on a Windows machine and you want to navigate your file structure and see where all your files are. So you might go to, music. And if you wanted to go into this directory contained within the music library called sample music, you double-click on that and it takes you in here. And then you have these three files which you can double-click on to access. So that's essentially this graphical user interface which we happen to have in operating systems like Windows. You see here that we don't really have that. We don't have images representing files. I can't click on anything and do anything at all. I can only interact with the keyboard here. The mouse isn't going to do me any good. So I need to have some way of being able to see what's there and access it. So the first tool at my disposal is ls, which is going to let me see what's in the directory I'm currently in. Okay. So I have all these words in blue. They're highlighted in blue because they're directories. So I have a directory called 2009, psets, public HTML, and section. So I'd kind of like to see what's in section. So I'm going to now move myself into another directory contained within this one by typing cd, change directory, and then after that, the argument section, the name of the directory I'd like to change to. Hit enter. And now you'll note that rather being in tilde, we're representing root, my root directory, the home directory I'm automatically placed in. I'm now in root/section. So if I type ls again, I now see all of the folders which are contained within section, and you'll see I've planned at least a few weeks in ahead. So that's great. So now I've been able to navigate down one level in the file the file system. What if I want to go up, back up a little bit? Okay, so. If I type cd space dot dot, that's going to kick me back up one level. So before I was in tilde/section, now I'm just in tilde because cd dot dot signals change directory that I want to go up one level. Also, some other notation. Dot represents whatever directory I'm currently in, so I could also write cd./section. Obviously, that's not really any better in this case than typing just cd section, but it's useful in other cases. And if I want to see the full path of the directory I'm currently in, I can type pwd, which means present working directory. And I'll see that although this is being represented as a tilde here, sort of an abstraction to represent what's root for me, on the computer that my account is actually on, this directory lives at home/chartier. So home contains a bunch of directories where multiple users have everything that they're using and have access to stored within it. So moving beyond just navigating the directory structure, let's talk about actually working with files. No files here, so let's go check in week one. Hopefully we've got some in there. Yeah, and we do, quite a few files. Just a heads up, the files highlighted in green are executable. Those are actual programs. The other ones are just text files, which either contain some text, or if they end with .c, perhaps contain some C source code, which we'll take a look at later. So going back one step, let's talk about how we can actually work with these files using commands in the terminal. So we have a variety of commands available to us, which sort of mimic the sort of things you'd be able to do with a file in a graphical user interface, like in Windows or Mac OS. Suppose I wanted to, rename a file. So I have, just some text.txt. So I want to rename that file. So I'll move just some text.txt and place that instead at some other text.txt. All right, and if I hit ls to check what's there now, I see I no longer have just some text.txt, and now I do have some other text.txt. If I had specified a different directory, if I had, for example, written made a directory called text files and written instead move just some text.txt text files slash some other text.txt, it would have been moved from its position within this directory to the other directory that was specified and placed there. So it's essentially moving it from one name path to another, and that can also include renaming the file itself. Copy. If I wanted two copies of some other text, I put cp, some other text, dot text, and then some text to dot text, and this should, yeah. So now I have two copies of the exact same file. And finally, if I don't want some file and I want to delete it, I can type rm for remove and get rid of some text too because it's just superfluous and I don't need it. And I'll be prompted if I really want to delete it, which is sort of like asking if you really want to delete your recycle bin, I guess. I can type y and enter, and that file is gone. So, all right. So that's about all you really need to know for working with files at this point. Let's talk a little bit about creating directories. So perhaps if you want to create your own pset directory to store psets from week to week rather than keeping all of them in a jumble in one folder, you'll be able to do that. The command for making a directory, if you decide to do so, is mkdir, make dir, make directory. So if I make a directory called text files, like I said earlier, type that in, hit ls. I now have a directory called text files. Cd text files will take me in there, as I'd expect. Nothing in here yet. Cd dot dot takes me back out, and it's still there. If I decide I don't really need that directory after all, I can type rmdir, remove directory, and then the name of the directory, and I don't need it, so I'll get rid of it now. And it's gone. That worked because that directory didn't contain anything within it. If we'd try to do that to a directory which did contain files, the operating system is generally going to want to discourage us from doing that, lest we accidentally delete hundreds of files or some huge directory containing multiple subdirectories. So it'll generally refuse to let you do that if you use remove dir. You can still do that if you'd like to using just the remove command, which you remember using with files, and adding this flag, dash r, which is a recursive remove. And if I had some directory containing subdirectories or files within a directory, I could type rm-r, then the name of the directory, and it would delete that directory as well as anything contained within it, though it would prompt you first to make sure you want to delete everything just to be safe. Okay, so with that information, which if I went a little fast speeding through some of it and you missed some details, you can certainly look up later on to get a better sense of exactly what keywords you can use. We're well equipped. Oh, yes. That's a very good point. You definitely do want to be very careful about removing any files when you're working within the Unix operating system, because whereas in operating systems like Windows OS and Mac OS, which we're familiar with using in our personal lives or at home, you have this safeguard, this recycle bin, which contains everything you deleted and gives you a second chance to get it back. That's not true in the Unix environment, and if you remove something, you will lose it, and that'll simply be the end of it. So do keep that in mind while you're working within your file structures, and don't type rm anything too hastily without double-checking that that's what you really want to do. Thank you for pointing that out. That's a very good point, and will probably save some people some frustration. Okay, so with that out of the way, let's talk about actually going into some of these files and doing something interesting with them. So we have this text file here called someothertext.txt, but it's just kind of there. I can't really do anything with it. I can type its name. It doesn't really want to let me do that. I'm supposed to proceed any commands with .slash. Let's see if now it'll let me. Oh, no, it's still, it's just a file. You can't just, use it as a command. The commands you type have to be programs, and they can take arguments. So what program would I normally use to open a text file? Well, I suppose I'd use some text editor like Notepad or gedit or textedit. So there is an equivalent which works on the command line found within the Unix system, one which we'll be using throughout the course because of simplicity. It's called nano. So to open a file in nano, I'm going to type nano and then a space, some other text.txt, just the name of the file I want to open, hit enter. The program nano will be launched, and I can see the contents of that text file. So this is just a kind of a silly little text file in some ASCII art. It says, oh, hi, this is CSI E52, and these little zeros, which are spread throughout the file. So, kind of sort of a pointless text file. It doesn't really do anything other than greet you. You're welcome. But it does allow us to sort of learn the ways of Nano, kind of get the ropes here and understand what we can do within this text editor, because especially for a novice who's not used to working in a terminal environment, it seems like we're very restricted in terms of what we can do. We can't click on anything. We can't jump immediately to somewhere in the file. It seems very limiting. But after you get the hang of it, it actually is not, and can be a little liberating because you get a lot faster using the keyboard. So let's explore some of the things we can do within Nano. First, the basics. If I want to leave Nano, note here that it says caret X exit. That caret represents the control key. So hold control, press X. Used to that meaning cut probably, but it means exit in Nano. And now I'm gone. Press up to go to the last command I typed previously, then enter it and go back in. Okay, good. Now I'm back in Nano. So what if I make some changes? And I want to keep these. So I use the write out command, control O. So I'm writing the changes I've made in this buffer, which is a temporary storage that contains the contents that were in the file, back out to the file, hence the name. You don't really need to know that, but that's just a brief explanation why it's not simply save. So control O to write out. It'll ask you for the file name you want to write to. It defaults to the file that you're already in, so if you wanted to save it as something else, you have the option to change it here. I don't really care. I'm happy with changing this file, so I'll leave it as is. Hit enter. If I leave and go back in again, you'll see that my changes are still there. What if I want to get rid of them? It's kind of a pain to go to the end of the line, hit backspace a bunch of times. I don't want to do that. I hit control K to cut out text. And then if I want to uncut it, I can press control U. What if I wanted this a bunch of times? I can just keep doing it. Just because I paste it back once doesn't mean I can't do it again. And in fact, if I wanted to cut multiple lines, which you might be used to doing by clicking and dragging and then hitting cut and then pasting it somewhere else, I simply hold control, press K as many times as I like, then press control U, and it pastes all those lines once again. So if you wanted to copy paste something, then you could kind of do that just by cutting out whatever it is you want to copy, pasting it back there, so it's still there. Since when I say copy, I mean take it from there without removing it. You do have to technically remove it and place it back before you can put it somewhere else. And then paste it down here as well. So just a simple way using the keyboard to use those cut, copy, and paste commands that we're familiar with and which are necessary to working efficiently within a text editor. Let's see. So in addition to closing, you may sometimes want to minimize Nano, which is to say you want to suspend the program and putting it in the background so you can do some things at the command line before you come back to it. You can do that within the Unix environment, perhaps surprisingly, perhaps not, by pressing Control-Z, which means to suspend. So now you see here that that process has been stopped temporarily, and I can type FG to bring it back into the foreground as if I had not minimized it at all. It's in the same state it was previously. So that's something that's very useful when you're working in a text environment, perhaps making some changes to your code, then you want to drop out to compile it, and then go back and make some changes again in case there are any errors, which there likely will be. Okay, so. Oh, in addition to working within a previously created file, you may at times want to create a new file, quite likely that you will, in fact. So in order to do that, you can just simply type nano and then name of the file to create, not literally that, but whatever you want to name, and then end it with a .txt extension if, in fact, you want to create a generic text file. Hit enter, and that file is created for me. I don't have to do anything special. I just provide the argument. If that file does not already exist, rather than opening a file that would be there, it creates one there and allows me to edit it. So there is text here now and here. And I can write this out. I see that it's there once again. I can go back to it. And let me introduce you to one more feature that you might find useful in Nano. If you ever want to do a find, for example, as you might be used to thinking it, a search for a particular text string within the file. So like, I knew I wrote the word here in this text file somewhere a second time, and I really want to find it, but I don't want to. Well, this is a bad example because it's really easy to see. But if you imagine for a moment, use your imagination that this is hundreds of lines long, it'd be a bit of a pain to scroll through all of it. So I can type control W, search, comes up. Type in the string I'm looking for, in this case here, hit enter. Okay, it appeared within there. If I hit Control W again, hit enter again, it goes to the next instance, Control W again, hit enter again, and it takes me to the last instance. So it's an easy way to scroll through all the occurrences of a text string, which you might find useful in the future if you want to get to a particular function very quickly. So, actually one more thing that might make your lives a lot easier. Suppose I did in fact have a very long file and I wanted to get through it quickly. Well, it's really a pain to sit here and scroll up and down to get through everything when I have 73 lines of code. Luckily, there's some keys on your keyboard that maybe some of you use, but some of you might have never touched that make this a lot easier. If I want to get farther down the page very quickly, page down, like four hits, and I'm down to the bottom page. Page up does the opposite. If I want to get to the end of a single line very quickly, I can type end. And if I want to get back to the beginning, I can touch home. The more ambitious amongst you might be able to look up some of the keyboard shortcuts that can do this even more quickly without moving your hands away. Control A is equivalent to home, Control E is equivalent to end, Control V is equivalent to page down, and Alt V is equivalent to page up. You don't... Did I press the... Or perhaps not in Nano. Oh, no, I'm thinking in terms of Emacs. Never mind, you don't need to worry about that. Just pretend I didn't say anything. Okay. But so now we've sort of learned the ropes of Nano to some extent. And at this point, we're actually ready to start thinking in terms of actually programming rather than just dabbling in these text files that don't really do anything all that interesting, at least in regard to what we're interested in doing, which is instructing the computer to do something interesting in the context of a computer program. So what exactly is C? This is the language we're going to be working in. It's a programming language. I'm sure most of you have caught on to that by now if you weren't aware before coming into the course. More specifically, it's a compiled language. If you've ever played around with a language like Python, where you're able to enter this interactive environment, and then as you type in the code, it magically does something as soon as you hit enter, that's different than what we're going to be doing in C. That's an interpreted language because as you're typing things in, the computer is actively interpreting what you type and doing something as a response. C, on the other hand, is a compiled language where you're expected to write up the entire program, then run it through a compiler which converts it from that C code into something the computer can actually understand. That's an important point to note. We're going to be writing in code that's human-readable. Some might scoff at human-readable, but it certainly is, into something that's much less human-readable called assembly code, which are these individual instructions that a computer is able to take in. At this point, that's more of a point of interest than anything, and please don't worry too much about it as we're just dealing with the bare aspects of C that we need to know to move on forward programming. But that's what it means for it to be a compiled language. It's also a typed language. We've talked a little bit in lecture, at least, about data types like int, double, float, char, and some of the types we've introduced in our CS50 libraries, which aren't technically C data types, but you can sort of use like them, such as a bool, which represents a Boolean value, and a string, which is like a collection of characters. And what it means for C to be a typed language is also, unlike Python or some other languages, when you specify some variable that contains that value, you have to tell what type of value you're going to be placing in it. You can't just say I equals 7. You have to say int I equals 7, or perhaps float I equals 7. If that seems a little cryptic at this point, that's okay, and we'll go into this more in depth. I'm just giving you some outlines as to what properties C has that makes it different from other languages so that you have an understanding of what you're becoming involved in, and also the knowledge that there are other languages that are a little different than this so you can adapt in the future. But enough of that. Let's talk a little bit about C programming by looking at an example program. So here we have perhaps the simplest program I could possibly write in C. It's the classic Hello World program. All it does is print out Hello World. But let's step through each of the different components within this program so we can sort of get an idea of the anatomy of a C program, how it's going to be structured, how exactly you should be writing up a C program. So up here, you'll see all of this in blue. That highlighting is just a property of the SSH client I'm using, PuTTY. It's filling that in for me just to make it easier to read. You'll note here that this block of text starts with a slash, then a sequence of asterisks, I only actually need one for this to happen, and then ends with asterisk star. So anytime you have any text which is between a slash asterisk and then another asterisk slash, anything in between those two things essentially doesn't count. The compiler isn't going to look at that. It's called a comment. And it's very useful for you because it allows you to provide information within your code, which is useful to people, but not necessarily useful to compilers. So you can use this to describe the program you're writing without actually providing any instructions to the computer or causing any problems with the compiler. You'll also note that below, in the same blue-colored font, we have a slash slash followed by some other comments. A slash slash differs from slash star then star slash because this is just a single line comment. If I were to carry this over onto the next line, it's not blue. I'm held accountable for what's there. The compiler will look at it, and if I were to compile this right now, the compiler wouldn't be happy because that is not valid C. So I can't have that. So anytime I want a comment, I have to place it between a slash star and a star slash, or place it on the same line as this slash slash. And just so there's no ambiguity, the slash slash must be at the beginning. Or if I wanted to put a comment off to the side, anything after the slash slash would be commented. That's generally not as good style. Below that, we have these lines here that say pound include or number sign include. Use pounder for the number sign. Followed by this argument within angle brackets. In this case, stdio.h. Can anyone tell me what that is exactly? Looks like studio, but that's not what it is.
Standard input output.
Right. So this is standard input output.h. stdio.h is the file's name. So that's some header file that's being included. And you'll note that we're also including the class's proprietary cs50.h header file, which includes some functions and other things that are useful for completing the problem set, which are found throughout the course. So what is this exactly? So a programming language just provides us with a set of syntactical tools, sort of a language and grammar by which to express ourselves, but it doesn't really give you anything else for free. So if you need some basic functions to be able to do some things, like, for example, printing text out to the terminal screen, you sort of have to provide those for yourself. Fortunately, we have the ability in C to include code, which has been provided by others in the past. So some very smart people that came before us were kind enough to provide us with standard input output.h, which, among other things, contains the function printf. So by including that at the top of the file, we're saying, okay, everything in standard input output.h, I want that. We're going to use it, deal with it, compiler. And then anytime I reference any function which is contained within that, that's okay. I'm allowed to do it because I remembered to include it at the top of the file. I could also use anything contained in the CS50 library within this code if I wanted to. I'm not in this case, but I would have that option. So after I've been sure to include all of the other code contained within header files that I might need, I'm able to start my program. So you note here that I write int main void. We'll think a little bit more about why exactly that is the case and what it means for us to have a main function with our code later on. Yeah?
I have a question about the header files.
Sure.
Does the CS50 header file live on the CS50 server, so you can only compile it on that server?
That's actually a very good question. So they do live on the server. They're installed on this server, so you are guaranteed to have access to them. You can also download them online. It's available somewhere on the website. I'm not exactly sure where, but if you go to cs50.net, you will be able to find them somewhere. If you wanted to use a header file like cs50.h in your code, which isn't necessarily installed on your system, what you can do is include that .h file manually within the same folder that you're working. So if I went to the directory I have this placed in and put it in there, that's okay. But in that case, rather than using these angle brackets, I would have to signal to the computer, the compiler rather, that you're looking for a header file which is not installed but is placed within this directory, so put it in quotes. But I'm not doing that in this case, so I'm going to change it back. Yeah. So anyone working on a different system, should note that if you want to include the CS50 header file, this is actually something that a lot of people may have to deal with, then just place it in the same directory you're working with and put it in quotes rather than angle brackets if you can't find a way to install it on your system somehow. And that'll essentially be kind of a hackish version of implementing that and being able to use it. All right, so now let's take a look at what's in the rest of this program. So for now, just know that int main void means this is the main function of my program, and when the program starts, I want you to do whatever's in here. So if we go to the command line and run this program, what's going to happen is it's going to execute this line of code, and then it's going to have no more lines of code, so it's going to quit. So let's take a look at what that looks like. Type gcc-o program.c. What I'm doing here is signaling to GCC, which is the GNU-C compiler. I want it to create output-o, this flag. I want it to create a program that's going to be called program, and the source code is in program.c. Source code refers to the file that contains all of the C language code that I wrote up to generate a program using the compiler. And since I happen to be including the CS50 library, even though in this case I technically don't need to, I'd place -l CS50 so that the compiler knows that it needs to link in the CS50 library. So if I hit enter now, it's compiled, and if I look, I indeed do have this program called program. It was technically there before, but I just compiled it again. So if you're wondering why, you might have seen it earlier in the video or earlier during this section. So now if I wrote program here, it doesn't work because the cloud requires us to include a dot slash for security reasons. Dot slash program. Oh, see, there's that dot again. Current directory slash program. And run it, and we do in fact get the expected output, which is hello world, the epitomal first C program. So now that we've sort of explored the anatomy of a C program and how exactly one is constructed, let's talk a little bit more about some of the building blocks of C that can help us make more interesting programs, because obviously something like this isn't going to be all that useful to us. It's a completely deterministic program that just does a set of steps that aren't very interesting. Printing a predefined message to the screen isn't anything that we're going to want to concern ourselves with for very long. So let's hop back in the PowerPoint for a minute and talk about conditions. So previously we were just iterating through each line of code one at a time, just at printf, and then we didn't have anything after that, but had we, it would have executed any other lines until we get to the bottom, at which point the program halts and returns us back to the terminal. So a condition makes things a little more interesting because rather than just iterating through each line, you include some sort of a if or if-else construct, which checks whether a condition is true, and then depending whether it is or not, we see branching behavior, such that we might do one thing or we might do another thing, depending on the conditions which exist in the program at that time. So whatever might be appropriate for that case. So a condition is essentially a Boolean expression, or you might also think of it as a logical expression. So it's really just something that is either true or false. So 5 greater than 4, that would be true in all cases. 4 less than 5, also true. 5 greater, or did I just say one that wasn't true? No, I don't think I did, but we won't worry about it if I did. 4 greater than 5 is false. So these are all technically conditions, but they're not very interesting. If you included perhaps an integer that you get from the user called int I and allowed the user to set the value, it could get a lot more interesting because then you're able to check, well, is the value they gave me less than 0? Because if it is, I want to do this. But if it's positive, then I want to do something else, or non-negative, I suppose, strictly speaking. So you could say, if I is greater than 0, do something, and then else, something else. And we'll see examples of this later if that is a little abstract at this point for those just jumping into programming. This is exactly like the if-else blocks which we used in Scratch, by the way, where you'd have if and then some condition that you were able to drag together. The only difference is now we're typing out the condition, and we have a lot more freedom to have more complex expressions without the tediousness of dragging things together. So, the value of a condition can also be evaluated and then set in a bool variable. A bool variable is one that's defined within the CS50 library and allows us to store values which represent true and false, and they can also be used within conditions, which we'll see shortly. All right. So just to sort of graphically display this, you can think of any condition as sort of a question having one of two possible answers. So anyone who might be familiar with the "Oh, really, owl?" He's an owl that sort of inherently begs a question, and the two possible responses are "Yeah, really," and no way. There's nothing in between. There's just those two. It's a finite set of two possible values, and that's what a Boolean is, and that's what a Boolean condition is. It's some expression that, depending on its truth value, is resolved to one or the other. So, you know, working with this same example, let's go ahead and open condition.c, which I've prepared previously. So if we have a bool data type, which once again we can use because we've included CS50.h, we can set this to be equal to false, for example. And then if that's true, which in this case it won't be, we would print, yeah, really. Else, we would print, no way. So what do we expect to happen? It should print no way. And let's see if that happens. So note that I just wrote make condition. It's sort of some shorthand which we can use on the cloud, which will just assume we want to make a file called condition using condition.c. Just sort of to speed things up, I already compiled, so I didn't actually have to do that. So let's take a look. Type condition, dot slash condition. I still need to get used to that. And we do, in fact, get no way. And just to ensure that this, to prove this construct does work the way I described, let's open it up one more time. Set this equal to true. Remake condition. We have to recompile because we changed the source. And now we get, yeah, really. So we've seen how using a condition, we're able to create a branching path of code such that if this is true, we do this. Else, if it's not true, we do that. Okay. Let's see. What should we want to know? Okay. So now that we have conditions, we can sort of build off of that and do something even more interesting, which is dealing with loops. So what a loop is, and this is a particular example of a loop called a while loop, there are multiple types, is it provides us some sort of way to say, here's a block of code, and I want you to do this repeatedly until some condition is satisfied. So it's like, I want you to do this, and I want you to do this until this condition. So it's sort of like an if block, except when you get to the end of it, you jump back to the beginning. So let's take a look at how exactly a while loop is constructed. So we see we have the key phrase while, and then contained within parentheses, I wrote condition. That just represents any condition. That could be a Boolean variable, like oh really in the previous example. It could be some expression like I less than 5, or it could simply be a Boolean value like true or false, although that would potentially be a little less useful if we just typed in that for perhaps obvious reasons. And then here, I've commented out, so it's not actual code and the compiler wouldn't see it, but a code block that is going to be repeated until the condition is no longer true. We also have for loops. So when we use a for loop, we provide a few more arguments than just the condition. We provide an initialization of some variable, a condition, much like the condition we used in the previous while loop, and then an update, and then some code block. So, let's see if we can relate that back to the while loop to get some intuitive understanding of what that means. Oh, actually, let's first do this quick demo to show an example for loop might be. So if I declared some int I equals 0, and then our condition was I less than 10, and our update was I plus plus, essentially what's happening here is the first time this is executed, it sets I equals to 0, checks whether I is less than 10, and of course it will be since I is initially set to 0, then executes the code block. Then after it's finished, it runs the update. I plus plus, if you aren't for that familiar with C syntax yet, just means I equals I plus 1, so add 1 to I. And then we'll check the condition again before executing the code. So how many times should this run? Oh, 10 times. I put it right on the slide. My bad. But yeah, so you can see how this is sort of a kind of a nice, concise way of representing what is essentially just a regular while loop where we want to use some counter in order to repeat some process a set number of times, or wherever it's natural to use some sort of counter to count up to something, whether it be a constant or something else, as you'll no doubt have much experience with by the end of the semester. Yes?
If we wanted to count I by 2, plus, plus, plus?
No. Plus, plus is actually just shorthand for plus 1. It's there because it's a very common operation. If you wanted to do plus two, then you would actually just write I equals I plus two. Or if you want to increment by any variable immediately, you can also just write I plus equals two. And that's just shorthand for this. So that would be what you'd have to type. Plus plus is just a special case where some additional syntax has been created for a very common operation just to simplify things. It's a good question. Okay, so let's relate this back to the while loop just to show that these are very similar and the for loop is just sort of a nice way of expressing it in a more concise way. So you'll note here the different pieces of text, which are highlighted in the same color, have the same exact functionality. So in this while loop, we're declaring this variable outside of the while loop, which we can use within it. So we're checking whether it's less than 10, executing this code, and then updating at the end, and then going back to the beginning, checking its value if it's less than 10, and doing this. And you'll see that naturally this will happen 10 times. What's the first number that will be printed, by the way?
Zero.
What's the last one that will be printed? Okay, that's something that you'll want to remember pretty much any time you use a for loop, since the general practice is to iterate starting at zero within a for loop and then use this less than condition so that you'll, if you say I less than n, you'll technically be iterating n times, but you're iterating from zero to n minus one as opposed to from one to n. This might seem counterintuitive since we're used to from basically almost since birth to count from one, but you'll see soon why this makes sense and it's best just to get used to it now and adopt it as practice. Okay. And these two loops are in fact equivalent. Okay. We also have a do while loop, another tool in our arsenal of loops. So in this case, we write do and then place the code once again within these curly braces. And then after that, we write while and our condition, followed by a semicolon. So unlike a while loop, we first check the condition after we've executed the code block one time. So we always execute the code at least once. And then if the condition is satisfied, then we'll execute again, and then we'll check again before executing. So this is sometimes a little confusing for people just starting out with this sort of thing because we're used to the condition being checked first and now it seems like it's getting checked last and what exactly does that mean and how can I think about that intuitively? I feel like the best way of understanding it is just to think of it as a do then while loop. So you do it once and then it essentially becomes a while loop. So you're guaranteed that the first time will always happen and then you check the condition much like in a while loop, before you ever do it again. This is useful in cases where, for example, you want to get input from the user, and then if that input doesn't satisfy some condition, for example, they gave you a negative answer and you didn't want that, you can prompt them again. So in cases where you definitely want to do something at least once, never zero times, but only sometimes you want to repeat it, or you just want to ensure that you're doing it at least once. This is something that's going to be less used than a for or a while loop, but there are definitely some cases, particularly when you're implementing functions which take it from the user, where this is better to use, and it's definitely something you should come back to, even if you don't feel comfortable using it right now. Okay, so I do have a few more demos for us to look at to get more familiar with writing programs in C, perhaps more interesting ones at least than program and condition. So let's first look at Kelvin.c. So this is a program which it converts temperatures in Fahrenheit to Kelvin. It's a pretty simple mathematical calculation. So what are we doing in this program? So we're first initializing this variable, and this is a very important point to make, which I did not bring up previously. If you want to use a variable within C, you have to first initialize it before you can ever refer to it again. And the way you do that is by writing the type of the variable. Once again, because C is a typed language, you must specify the type for any variables you used, and then the name you want to use. So in this case, I'm declaring a variable called fair for Fahrenheit, which is of type float. And now I can use it, and anytime I refer to that, The computer says, oh, it's that variable called fair that contains a float value. I know what that is. If I wanted to, I could combine these two lines and declare and then initialize the variable within the same line. That's also acceptable. But the first time you use a variable, it must have at least previously been initialized or being initialized in that line. You can't use a variable before it's been initialized because the compiler simply won't know what it is and the computer won't be able to handle it and the program won't be created. Okay, so then we're printing this line of text, which prompts for a temperature in Fahrenheit. And now we're using this function that's available in the CS50 library called getFloat. And what that does is pause and wait for the user to type in some number which represents a float, continues to prompt them until they give them a float, and then after they do successfully do that, assigns that value over to this variable fair. This will return that float value, and then it will be assigned using the assignment operator to the variable fair. Does anyone have any questions about that, by the way? I don't want to skim over things that might seem intuitive but aren't. Okay. Oh, yes.
My understanding is that when you declare the type without an assignment, it's a declaration. You first give it a value, that's the initialization.
Yes, that's correct. So just to drive that home once again, this is declaring a variable. And if I were to place some value here after an assignment operator, that would be initializing the variable. So as I'm declaring it, I'm initializing it to some value. This is actually generally good practice, though I'm not doing it here because it's a very simple program. In more complicated programs, as David pointed out, I believe in the last lecture, or perhaps the one before that, it's generally better to initialize it to some value because when you don't initialize it to something, you actually can't make any guarantees about what's created there. Fair, for example, in this instance, is probably not zero. It could be, but it could just as easily be some random value that was stored in memory previously. We don't have to worry too much about the mechanics of that just yet. We'll come back to that later. But do know that if you don't initialize a variable to something, you can't make any guarantees. I don't know that's zero, and I should not depend on that unless I initialize it to zero. Yes?
So would initializing it in the same line as you're getting the input count as initializing it? So if you did the float fair equals get float, does that count as initializing it because you are getting a value there?
So you would be initializing it to some value that's being passed in, yeah. It's not so important that you're typing in some value to initialize it to, so much as you should give it some value before you counting on it having a value that you gave to it, because otherwise it could actually be anything. And that's all stuff that's under the hood, and you don't need to worry about that too much just yet, but do know that's why you should always initialize your variables. And I'm perhaps not giving a good example of that right now, but seeing as this is a very simple program, it's not such a big deal. All right, so at this point, we have in fair stored a temperature in Fahrenheit. So down here, I'm declaring and initializing this other variable called Kelvin, which is labeled as a float, to the value fair minus 32, this term, times 5 divided by 9 plus 273, which just happens to be the formula to take a temperature in Fahrenheit to Kelvin. So now, assigned to Kelvin, I should have whatever this value, minus 32, multiplied by 5/9 plus 273 is, and that should get stored in Kelvin. And then you'll see here that I'm using this line to print out the Kelvin conversion. So you'll see I'm specifying here that this is something we'll talk more about later. This is just a way of specifying how wide and how precise I want this number to be. So the number of digits it takes up on the screen and the number of decimal places I want to go out to, that'll be covered more later on. And a float, and I provide as an argument what that float is. It's stored in Kelvin. And any questions on that? Okay. And then down here, we're actually making use of a condition, because if Kelvin is less than zero, it doesn't really make any sense. For those of you who perhaps haven't used Kelvin in a while, that's because Kelvin is based off of absolute zero, so anything below zero Kelvin doesn't make any sense, because zero Kelvin would be absolute zero and no energy. All right. Just a little science in the middle of the section. Okay, so we're going to make Kelvin now and type it up. dot slash Kelvin, once again. Fahrenheit temperature?
Minus 300.
Minus 300. 88.56 Kelvin. And if I go a little farther back, let's see, how far back do I have to go? Minus 500. That Kelvin conversion would be negative 22.56, and since that is below absolute zero, we've triggered our condition, and we get this extra behavior that says that doesn't make any sense. Okay. Does anyone have any questions on any of the semantics in C or anything that we've seen during section today? Sure.
In the Kelvin program, it says the
question is off. Sure, let me pull it back up. Oh. Yes?
What's in the parentheses next to main?
Oh, okay. So that's something that has just been introduced in the lecture today. Previously, we had void place there, which meant that we could assume that the program was not taking any command line arguments. Int argc and char star argv are just a way of representing what words have been passed in as arguments. I was actually going to delete that because we don't need to worry about it just yet, but since it is there and you brought it up, that is what it's for. Argc is actually the number of command line arguments, and char star argv is a way of representing all of those words that were passed in. And that's something we'll talk about later more in depth. But yeah, good eye for noticing that difference. Any other questions? Okay, so before we break in just a couple minutes, I did want to touch a little bit on the grading policy in the course just to give everyone a very strong sense of what metrics we're grading along. So just to reemphasize this, I'm sure it's been covered in lecture, but just to give you another take on it. The three metrics we grade along are correctness, design, and style on every problem set. On problem set zero, we graded on just correctness, or will be grading on just correctness, as you'll see when you get your Scratch projects returned to you graded. On the first problem set, correctness is out of 5, 1 to 5, not including 0. And design and style, last year we're out of 2. I believe they might be out of 3 this year. I can't confirm one way or the other just yet. I'm not sure. But correctness seems very obvious what that's about. If you look in the problem set specs, it very clearly enumerates to you what exactly your program should do and some corner cases you might want to look out for. So like if the problem set spec says you need to handle any integer value that's passed in, you'll want to make sure you do the appropriate thing when it's less than zero or greater than that. And in all cases, it should do whatever it is you intend to implement or are assigned to implement. All of these corner cases won't necessarily be enumerated every single time in the problem set spec, so it will be up to you to some extent to determine what sort of cases you might get that you might not expect, which could cause problems with your program. It is your responsibility as a programmer to be able to handle whatever input is passed in from the user. A lot of the problems you see with programs that use in your everyday life where you end up getting a program stuck in a loop and it crashes and it won't become responsive is because some programmer at some point did not intend some combination of events to occur and end up in a state that the program couldn't handle, resulting in a crash. So part of being a good programmer is learning how to address all possible cases and try to predict those and act accordingly. So correctness will that'll be assessing how well you do that, as well as how well you meet all the requirements of the problem set. Design is a little more abstract and a little more difficult than correctness to attain high marks on, but very much within the reach of anyone in the course. Design is referring to the efficiency with which a solution is implemented. So it's like how well thought out and how, I don't want to say just good, but how good your approach and your implementation is of the problem. So it's easy to imagine how one could do something very inefficiently, having a computer go through a large number of steps when much fewer were needed. I'll give more examples in the future because I don't want to give away too much on this first problem set, but this week design is a little less important because there are less possible options available to you, but you should certainly think about what you're doing and whether or not you could find some way to. Well, one example is, suppose you were writing a function to multiply numbers together, and you, instead of using the multiplication operation that's available to you, simply like added up, then if you have n times x, you just added n to itself x times rather than just using multiplication, which would be a lot easier. That's an example of something that's inefficient. There are tools available to you which allow you to do things more efficiently, and you did it in a less efficient way. And that'll become more complex in the future, and there's a lot of different ways of thinking about approaching problems that'll become more important later, but just give you an idea now of what we mean when we say design. That's essentially a breakdown of it. Finally, there's style. Style refers to how your code looks, essentially. So you'll want to have consistent indentation. You'll notice that in a file like this, we see that all the code within a code block contained within these curly braces is indented by four spaces. It doesn't have to be four. If you prefer two, that's okay too. But if you prefer two in one place in your file and then four in another, that's not okay. You do need to be consistent so that your code is easy to read. You should have comments throughout your code which describe what's going on so that anyone reading it doesn't necessarily have to read every single line of C code to understand what's happening in the program at all. Just intersperse throughout to say what different code blocks do. So it essentially comes down to that. What we sometimes refer to as prettiness of your code, its readability, the degree to which everything is arranged nicely so that it's intuitive to go through and understand how things are related to each other. Naming variables, things that make sense. If I'd called fair X and Kelvin Y, it'd take a little more effort on the person reading the code to figure out what was going on. Good variable names are good style. Indentation is good style, consistent indentation. And commenting throughout your code to ensure that anyone reading it has an easy time figuring out what you did is also good style. And as long as you remember these things, this is actually the metric that I personally feel is the easiest one to do well on, and it'll boost your scores on problem sets. So just early on in the course, keep that in mind, and do make an effort to write your code in good style, because this is something people lose points on unnecessarily every year. Okay, so having provided you with that information, we've covered everything that we're going to get through this week, so I'll see everyone next week. Have a good night.